Good afternoon, everyone. We are happy to have you here with us today. We have a very special guest. In fact, all of our guests are special. But this topic, you know, we have sort of addressed several times in this series. And again, we're in our fourth year. But the idea of how do you have a police officer or several police officers in a department and they remain in that department, the whole department knows about them, the community knows about them, and how you know, this has been a puzzle that we've been trying to address for several years now. And we hope that our guest today, in fact, we think that our guest today will definitely enlighten us when it comes to what's going on in terms of the latest legislation and so forth. And one of us saw an article in the LA Times called Opinion, California Might Have Thousands of Cops Who Are Unfit to Wear a Badge. This is why. Very, very provocative title. So I'm going to stop here and just kind of wet your whistle a little bit and turn it over to my colleague, Matt, who will be acknowledging the land that we sit on now. Matt?
Thank you, Professor. We recognize that California State University San Bernardino sits on the territory and ancestral land of the San Manuel Band of Mission Indians, the Uhaviatam. We recognize that every member of the California State University San Bernardino community has benefited and continues to benefit from the use and occupation of this land since the institution's founding in 1965. Consistent with our values of community and diversity, we have a responsibility to acknowledge and make visible the university's relationship to Native peoples. By offering this land acknowledgement, we affirm Indigenous sovereignty and will work to hold California State University San Bernardino more accountable to the needs of American Indian and Indigenous peoples. I'll turn it over now to Robbie.
Thank you, Matt. I'd like to add my welcome. We do have a special guest. So it's a pleasure to introduce Julia Yu. She is a civil rights attorney at Iredale & Yu, a civil rights and criminal defense firm based in San Diego, representing clients in state and federal courts. She serves as president of the National Police Accountability Project, the country's largest civil rights attorneys organization. She's the first woman of color to hold this leadership position. And as Mary mentioned, she's the author of a recent LA Times opinion piece titled California Might Have Thousands of Cops Who Are Unfit to Wear a Badge. This is why. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Yu.
Thank you so much for that introduction, and thank you so much for having me. This is a wonderful series, and I'm so honored to be a part of it. I'm hoping that if there are any questions, you will stop me during my presentation so that we can have more of an engagement. So to start with, I want to give a little bit of background to the type of cases that we're talking about when we're talking about decertification and post what that is. And I want to describe one of my cases because it is so deeply personal to me and that family. And this describes how the failure of the state and sometimes the department to take action and hold police officers accountable tends to create a repeat circumstance in which police officers escalate their misconduct. So I want to start with the story of Valeria Tachiquin Alvarado. 11 years ago, Valeria went to visit a friend in his apartment, and she left the apartment not knowing that the friend had been under investigation. The law enforcement officials did not have sufficient evidence against the friend to have a search warrant. There was certainly not enough information to have an arrest warrant. The only legal authority they had over the friend was a knock and talk. And that's exactly how it sounds. They are authorized to show up at a free person's home. They're authorized to knock on the door and they're authorized to talk. They have no authority beyond that. And there was a Border Patrol agent named Justin Tackett that was part of the five-man team that arrived at this home. So when they arrived, they were in plain clothes. the requirement for knock and talk is that the initial contact with the target or any other citizen has to occur with somebody in uniform, and that makes sense. That is a common rule when somebody is undercover, because it can be a terrifying situation, especially if they're armed, if the person does not recognize that they're law enforcement and they think that they are being attacked. So for the safety of the officers and safety of the people, it is always required that the contact occur with somebody in uniform. When they arrive, though, all five people are in plain clothes. Justin Tackett was wearing a baseball hat, a pair of jeans, and a red t-shirt. He was hiding any credentials so that it was not visible. He did that on purpose. When they arrived at the home, they saw Valeria leaving, and they start to engage her. And Tackett is following her as she is leaving the apartment, demanding to know her name and date of birth. She hadn't done anything. She doesn't even know what's going on. She doesn't even recognize that they're law enforcement. So she's a little scared, and she continues to walk very quickly to her car. Tackett then says, "If you don't answer my questions, I am going to arrest you." He had obviously no authority to do that. He didn't even know who she was, which is why he was asking for her identity. She gets into her car and she is terrified and she's trying to get away. Tackett stands in front of her car and asks one of the other agents to smash her window. So the other agent is standing by her driver's side, smashes the window, and there is broken glass now all over her. As she is trying to get away, he claims that she nudged him, even though there is no physical evidence of injury on his body. He says, though, that she nudged him. He then jumps onto the hood of her car. She drives approximately 500 to 700 feet. She comes to a stop because he is still on the hood of her car. He gets off the car, and as she is slowly driving away from him in reverse, he takes out his revolver and shoots at her car as she is moving away 10 times. One of the witnesses who saw it called 911 and said that she thought this was an execution, because obviously she didn't know what was happening. She didn't hear any commands. There was no identification of police. She saw a man in a baseball hat shooting a woman 10 times and killing her. This story would be tragic enough as it is, but it really added to the sense of tragedy for the community and for the family members because of who Justin Tackett was and what his background was. So let me describe for you what Justin Tackett had done to other people during his employment with the sheriff's department. This is before he became a border patrol agent. In one instance, he disobeyed orders and failed to stand by and wait for a Brawley police officer because it was their jurisdiction. He rousted the owner of the home, engaged him in an altercation. He handcuffed him and took him into custody. There was no basis for him doing that. The Imperial County Sheriff's Internal Affairs determined that Tackett violated several department policies, including those prescribing incompetence and conduct unbecoming of an officer. Then the department also investigated Tackett's disobedience of an order that he not engage in probation searches. He had been going around doing that. He had no authority to do so. That was not a part of his job. But he was going around rousing people just to give them a hard time. So they gave him a direct order not to do that. That investigation revealed that he willfully disobeyed a direct order from his supervisors, provided false and misleading information during the investigation, misrepresented information in order to hide that he was doing probation searches, and intentionally violated his suspension order. A couple years later, there's a citizen who files a citizen's complaint stating that Tackett entered his home without a warrant, handcuffed him, searched his property and person without consent, Tackett then placed him in his patrol car with all of the windows closed on a hot day with the air conditioning off. An independent investigator found that Tackett unlawfully entered the home, searched and handcuffed him without legal justification, unlawfully searched his workshop, unlawfully removed property, and left the citizen in the hot patrol vehicle and failed to thoroughly and truthfully report the incident to the department. The poor man in that car could not breathe because it was so hot in that car. He had to smash that window open with his feet after multiple attempts because he thought he was going to suffer heat stroke. It was the middle of a summer day. As if that wasn't enough, that same year, Tackett effected a traffic stop on somebody. And then he made that driver take him to the motel room where he had been staying. There was no basis for that. He searched the motel room and found drug paraphernalia. And there, an independent investigator found that he engaged in unlawful conduct because there was no basis for him doing that from the word go. So that same year, after these repeated instances, the Sheriff's Department served on him a notice of proposed disciplinary action, and it was a notice to terminate. After receiving that letter, Tackett quit instead of being fired, so that if a question arose as to whether he's ever been terminated from employment in law enforcement, he could say no. Then 2 years later, he did not answer the questions truthfully to some other questions, and he got a job with Border Patrol. So it was after a series of findings of various misconduct, serious misconduct, that he was allowed to have this position of authority over people. And that's when our client, Valeria, died. She left 5 children and a husband. So that's a backdrop of the kinds of incidents that had been happening in California, because even when in circumstances where the department does do the right thing and does investigate and wants to take some action, it permitted in the past people to jump from one department to another and start all over again because there was lack of transparency. Because we don't keep tabs on misconduct of officers. So I want to go back and talk a little bit about what POST is. It's POST. So California has a Commission on Peace Officer Standards and Training. And obviously the commission does exactly that. They look at the standards, they set forth training, they certify police officers so that they have a license to be law enforcement official in this state. But it had no mechanism to decertify police officers or have any uniformity of discipline, right? So a department could have a different level or different mechanism for disciplining or not disciplining its employees. So back in 2021, SB 2 passed. The Senate Bill 2 made some significant changes, authorizing POST, short for Commission on Peace Officer Standards and Training, allowing POST to go through a rigorous process to decertify officers in California. And once you're decertified, you may not work again as a peace officer in California for another department. It also would make that list public for the sake of transparency and for public accountability. So that was the intent of it. It faced a lot of challenges. I think there was some fear on the part of the unions and police officers that they would lose their licenses for little things. They kept on referencing parking tickets, and if I get into a traffic accident, they're going to take away my livelihood. There was a lot of misinformation. It actually took us 2 years to pass. The first year, it was SB 731. It failed on the floor of the assembly. We brought it back the following year. And it finally passed, and it went into law in January of 2022. So you are not going to lose your license. So there are certain standards on decertification. So the serious misconduct that we're talking about is dishonesty, abuse of power, physical abuse, sexual assault, bias, acts that violate the law, participating in law enforcement gangs, which we have seen, which is very disturbing, failure to cooperate with an investigation, and failure to intercede. So we're talking about very serious, significant levels of misconduct for which you can be decertified. So one of the other issues that was brought up during the legislative efforts was that there would be, if this bill passed, there would be mass exodus of police officers, and that we would be facing a crisis. Who would enforce the laws if there is no officer left behind? That they would all leave, and we would be, you know, inundated with crime everywhere. But I think what's really interesting is that we don't hear things like that about any other profession that is regulated. And as I mentioned in the article, there are millions of people whose jobs are regulated for the safety of the public. It includes doctors, lawyers, plumbers, electricians, anybody that provides a service where they could do harm to somebody. So I was using this example, but it could be any profession. If you went somewhere to receive a service like a facial and your esthetician got drunk and burned your face because they used too much acid, there wouldn't be this reaction from the public saying, oh, we can't regulate people who give you facials because what if, you know, we fire the ones that got drunk and burned you? You know, that would be a terrible thing. Well, it wouldn't be a terrible thing. So I want to fast forward to what is happening now as a result of SB2. What has been revealed by Post is they're anticipating about 3,000 to 3,500 officers that will be decertified under SB2. That counts for approximately 4% of the 90,000 peace officers we have in this state. And as I think I gave an interview to another paper, they wanted my reaction to it. And I said that I was not surprised by the numbers, but that the community indeed should be concerned that these thousands of people, and certainly a lot of them have already been let go, but that for many departments, these officers were allowed to continue to serve, fully knowing that they committed misconduct that rises to the level of decertification. And that should be concerning for all of the citizens that have either interaction with the police or really believe in the civil rights of everyone. So I want to sort of wrap this up a little bit about my own personal view and my personal experience, and hope to answer some questions. So the question always comes up about, what do I think would be the consequence of SB2 long-term, and how do I see this playing out? Even though I've been doing this for 25 years and I think sometimes I'm a little bit jaded, I remain hopeful that this really empowers not just Post, but it really empowers all of us. One, I think having this kind of accountability and transparency builds so much trust in the community itself, particularly in communities where people feel targeted, people feel unheard, that when they lodge a complaint, they're turned away. When they say this officer mistreated me, nobody believes them. I think to have this mechanism is so significant that people can speak up, right? And feel like there's a community behind them and that there is a process that assists them in some way. I think that's so helpful, not just for the community members, but I really do believe this process makes it better for the good officers, because the assumption is that, you know, these officers are terrible But I think this process encourages the good officers to feel pride in their profession. By way of example, my best friend has been in law enforcement for 30 years, and she just retired 2 years ago. And she's the kind of a police officer that you want in your department. She received a commendation for risking her own life to save the life of a prisoner. People who really serve out of a sense of duty and obligation, who want to make this world a better place. And I think when you have this stigma that even the bad cops never face any consequence, and you can't tell which one's a good one or a bad one when you have an interaction with them. And I think to know that there is accountability really will attract, I think, a better crop of police officers coming in. And if we have a mass exodus of police officers who are leaving because they don't want to be held to account for their misconduct, I would say that's a really good result to have with that kind of exodus. I think the second part of this is that the level of transparency is so critical. So for me as a lawyer, if lawyers engage in conduct that, you know, hurts the client, whether they commingled funds or they didn't return a phone call in a timely fashion, or they did something bad in a case, that information is made public. Our discipline is made public. The entire process is made known to the public so that there is a sense of confidence. But the flip side of that is that it does help us self-regulate because we know that we're going to be held to account. So I think any time that there is public transparency, it encourages the people, the employees, to bring their best selves to work, being mindful that they are being watched, not in a really negative way, but knowing that they come to this job with a great level of responsibility, which is only appropriate with their commensurate with the level of power that is given to them by the community. They only have that power because there's a social contract that we as the citizens, the people, the residents of the state of California have given them this power. So they have to take equal level of responsibility to us in exchange. I'm going to look at any questions that might be in the chat, but please.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, that it is amazing that we've been doing this for several years now, like I said, and that we have not emphasized this SB 2. I don't know how we missed that, or maybe someone mentioned it and we just kind of, you know, glossed over it or whatever, but this seems really big. And I'm wondering if you have seen any significant change in the way the law is enforced in California since SB 2.
Sure. I think it'll be really interesting to see maybe 10 years down the road so we can look back and have a better statistical analysis.
So too soon.
Yeah, it's too soon. Because, you know, they really just started to roll out the process. So we will see what impact this has, how many people end up being decertified, and what happens internally to each of the departments and the way they look at discipline, whether they take in the complaints. What I have heard repeatedly from other lawyers and community members is that some departments have refused to take citizen complaints, that they are turned away, they're not given the forms, and it's not taken seriously. But now that they have an overarching organization that will be participating in this process, I don't know that they will continue to behave that way because they will be under the microscope, and especially because there is transparency now. So if they have refused to do their jobs and it moves forward anyway through a process to get to post, and it comes to light that a part of the problem is that they were not accepting complaints, I think that would be a really useful information for the public to have.
Right. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Michael.
Thanks. One of the issues that you raised in your piece was that there was a budget proposal that would have taken away funding for the public transparency aspect of the bill. How did that come about, and is it still a threat to the?
Sure. So at the time the piece came out, there was some upheaval because Governor Newsom had said that he would sign a budget that slashed it significantly, making it not possible for there to be transparency and making documents public. There was incredible pushback from the community because I think you can't have accountability without transparency. So I know that there was a lot going back and forth. There was an interim budget that was signed after that that keeps it status quo. And I don't know if there's going to be a final budget. I have not heard anything from the interim budget to now, whether that piece will be taken out for now or whether that budget is back in.
Great. So something for us to keep up with because
absolutely,
it's under threat still.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. And did Governor Newsom justify his decision to cut the budget?
Sure. After the community members came forward and really opposed that, I don't think he made a public statement justifying the cuts in the budget, other than to say that, you know, the budget is a problem and we need to cut the budget. I don't think there was justification to say that it's not money well spent or that transparency is a bad thing. I don't think any public official can make that statement.
Well, Republicans can, but that's another story. So that's the only editorial comment I'll make. We do have some great questions. Matt, do you want to read the first one?
Well, actually, I have a question that I think is going to encompass one of these. So, I was a post member from 88 to 95, so a little bit before you started in this work. Police officers have always had sort of have been insulated either by the local entity, which tend to be self-insured. And in many cases, it's just easier to write a check rather than go through the process. Insulated by civil service requirements, progressive discipline. So you can't go from one incident directly to termination. Protected by, and this is the question that's in our Q&A, about unions. Are police not somewhat protected by the union? Wouldn't that keep them in certain positions? So how does SB2 cut through all of that insulation?
Sure, thank you for that question. And I love having you here with your experience with POST. I think this is so wonderful. I should be throwing you some questions. But yes, of course, California does have very strong unions, in particular, the police unions. The reason why we didn't have much transparency over the years is because they opposed it. Senator Skinner has introduced several bills in the last several years. Some have passed. There is one that has passed this year through the Assembly and the Senate. It's on the governor's desk right now. It deals with transparency of internal investigations and whether that's going to be made public or not. It had been shrouded in mystery and secrecy for decades. But if Governor Newsom signs that bill, when there is an in-custody death, for example, and there's an investigation, that information will be made public as of January of 2024. So yes, absolutely. There has been so many layers where you have to cut through that to get to any level of transparency. And that has always been the case. Here, what you're talking about is, does SB2 get rid of any layers of protection that the police have that others do not? It does in some senses because, as you know, I think before this bill passed, none of that information from POST could have been revealed because there's a California law that says you cannot reveal information about peace officers. So yes, there are certain mechanisms by which we can have public access to these records. But as to the other component of what you were saying is the levels of protection of due process, as to each of the departments, SB2 does not dictate what the departments themselves can do, because they do have to go through the process of civil service. And that's right. for any public employee, though, not just peace officers. Right. So they're still entitled to their due process, which I actually think is a good thing. It's not a bad thing.
I saw there was one question. I think it was the first one, Matt, about, you know, why are these police departments hiring these horrible people? And I too, Julia, you lucked out today, because I'm also post-certified in California. I was with the LA Sheriff's Department for a number of years. And I'll let you answer that question. But from my point of view, those 18 years, people who join police departments are not horrible people. They're not. You know, I'm not horrible. Matt's not horrible. However, the experience and the pressure, and I'm sure you know this, Julia, the experience and the pressure of being day in and day out working with these hard, you know what, cops, you know, you change. I don't know anyone who went in a police department and came out the same way. You know, work changes us, you know, in general, but certainly policing makes you, you know, speaking of insulated, it makes you very insulated. It makes you want to hang out with nothing but other cops. Those other folks don't understand us, right? So I would like to sort of defend somewhat. I can't believe I'm saying this, actually. defend policing in that I think they make good faith efforts to get, you know, decent human beings. It's just that everyday experience just, you know, it changes you. It really changes you. You become distrustful, you know, all of that stuff. So what are your thoughts on that, Julia?
Sure. I 100% agree with you. I see so many officers joining the force because, you know, like my best friend, they wanted to do something good for the community. And I think when they see this us versus them mentality, and they are facing, they feel attacked by the community they serve. And then they do become like, okay, well, I can only get support and have this fellowship with other police officers. And because of that, I can't come forward and report somebody else's misconduct, right? So there is that, you know, that sense of solidarity that we do not violate that oath, right? To protect each other, I have to have their back. Mm. And in part, that is self-preservation.
Yes.
If I don't have your back, you know, when I'm looking down a serious situation, am I going to have, you know, am I going to have people backing me up? So because of the intensity of their work, I think their bond is strong. And because of that bond, they can't come forward. Mm-hmm. And so when there is one bad cop, right, it's not easily solved, and it permeates, because you watch your fellow officer violating somebody's civil rights and you let that go. And then eventually it becomes the norm. And then you expect that to happen and you become okay with it, right? So that's really the culture, and that's where it is dangerous. Precisely, yes, I'm so glad you hit that. Because it's not, I'm not worried about, you know, people joining who are just terrible people from the get-go, because we do now have mechanisms to really, if the departments want to do it, to screen those people out. You know, they're testing that they can do to see if they're fit to serve, whether they have anger management, whether they have gang affiliation, whether they're, you know, they have certain racist tendencies, all of those things. I don't think departments go out looking for trouble. I think where really we have to be cautious is encouraging law-abiding, law-respecting police officers to be their best selves. Like, how do we as a community support that? And again, I think this level of transparency and respect for the profession is going to help really encourage, you know, getting good people in, but also growing that community of good officers. When we were working on SB 2, I'm sorry, I should explain. I worked on these SB 731 and SB 2. It was introduced, they were both introduced by Senator Bradford, and I served as his technical expert on the other component of SB 2, which dealt with California civil rights law. And my counterparts at the ACLU worked on the decertification component. So I had sort of an inside view of the bills as they were winding its way up to the governor's desk. So yes, I want to emphasize that this is such a critical thing for us to look at. And I do think that this will be encouraging a better sense of environment of accountability.
Okay. I have one question from the chat. I think this is a good transition to this question, which is, how do you become a civil rights attorney? And what was your journey to getting there? And I'd be interested in, how do you go about founding a nonprofit to do this kind of civil justice work?
So I actually had no interest in becoming a lawyer. I went just on a whim, really. I graduated from college, went back to Korea to work at Samsung, and then I wanted to come back, didn't know what I wanted to do. So I'm like, well, just go to law school and then I'll figure it out later. I had no intention of becoming a lawyer, but my last year, I think my second year actually, I started to volunteer for an organization providing legal services to people in prison. And then I was just hooked. I started to work with women in prison and in jails and girls. And I knew that I had really found my home. So I knew that I wanted to serve them. I had no idea that I would start litigating these cases, but I started a nonprofit called Law Center for Women Prisoners. And it was just to provide pro bono legal services for whatever their needs were. And then I moved to San Diego to practice law with my partner, who does criminal defense work and some civil rights. And so we started just to do all kinds of civil rights litigation. The organization where I serve as the president is the National Police Accountability Project. And I've served now for the third year as the president. I'm about to step down. And that organization was started a little bit before my time. It's been in existence for about 25 years. It was started by a whole bunch of civil rights luminaries from the East Coast and West Coast. And we are the largest civil rights organization with about 600 attorneys. So that one I did not start, but it is near and dear to my heart. And how do you get started on this? You can email me if you want to get to know more about the organization. I'm happy to connect you. Our goal really is to teach the next generation of lawyers to be able to do this, but also really standing up for the community members themselves. So we are always here to speak up, and whether it's legislative work or being a liaison or teaching, whatever it takes to see, you know, justice, especially racial justice in this country.
We have a little bit more time, if you can spare the time. I think we have Matt, a few more questions.
Yeah, I have one. So unlike the state bar or some of the other states' licensing agencies, Post historically has only been about standards and training and has not had an enforcement or investigative units. Is SB2, does that address that, to kind of get past individual department cultures?
So I don't know that SB2 really got into the mechanisms of how it's going to be executed. So that's up to Post. Mm-hmm. And we put this in the good hands of the members of Post. But really, it is giving a leeway, a mechanism for them to do that. So what, you know, I don't know that it is good for the legislature to micromanage mm-hmm. how things are done. By Post, I think it's a better idea to really, you know, give them an opportunity to do this.
Just to sort of piggyback on what Matt was saying, we had a guest here several months ago by the name of Cerise Castle, who has done some phenomenal work on the LA Sheriff's Department and gang. She's a journalist. What is it going to take via this mechanism, POST and SB2, to get rid of those officers? I imagine it's going to be quite complicated.
It will be, yes. I think it has to be such a partnership. You can't just leave it to POST.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It has to involve the departments. It has to involve supervisors who are not fearful. Yeah. It has to be the individual officers themselves that say, I witnessed something and it was a travesty. I'm going to come forward and report it. It also takes citizens, and I'm not talking about just victims of civil rights. I'm talking about people who witness it. You know, when I was talking about Valeria's case, there were witnesses who called in and expressed outrage over what they saw. You know, this entire process, I have to tell you, from SB 731 to getting it to the governor's office, it was not just lawyers. It was driven by the passion of the community members, impacted families who made those phone calls, right? Who spoke up and told their beautiful personal stories. That's what it takes to change this community. It's not lawyers. We can't litigate our way out of this problem. We can't just legislate this, right? It has to involve everyday people who will speak up and demand that there be action taken. We don't wait until there is a horrible incident like George Floyd to speak up. We do it every day because it's our obligation.
Thank you.
And I think you're exactly right that the transparency that SB2 required is essential, not just to hold the police officers and the police departments accountable, but to hold POST accountable. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a POST law enforcement officer. I was federal. I was with the FBI, but was involved in some investigations of law enforcement members. And it was often difficult to get the kind of information that now will be public record and not easy to ignore, right? Mm-hmm. Because just getting a no back from a police department was enough to say we couldn't get any more information, send it up to the U.S. Attorney's office to get a declination. So I think the whole system has to be accountable, and I commend you for that work. But we also have to hold POST accountable. One of the problems that we've seen, and this comes up in one of the questions from the audience, is about the training that police officers are allowed to receive that POST has approved. You know, and I know of it in the parlance as warrior cop training, you know, that teaching a very aggressive, threatening sort of type of policing. So are there accountability measures that can be applied to make sure that that training is appropriate? And I'll raise two specific There was a scandal involving all law enforcement agencies with counterterrorism training that presented Muslims and Arabs as backward and inherently violent. And, you know, even the FBI had to go in and pull out 800 pages of their counterterrorism training. But more recently, there have been far right trainers who provided some conspiracy theories and other information, and even a group called the Constitutional Sheriffs that does training. And in Arizona and in Texas, their POST systems approved them. Texas has since rescinded that, but I believe it's still in effect in Arizona. So are there ways to get transparency in who's a police trainer, who's approved, who's done that approving, and what the courses are?
Sure. So this is actually the part where litigation and lawyers are useful. Because when things go bad, and the question is whether this officer acted a certain way because of the training, and when you're reviewing that, you have an opportunity to review who is doing the training, what is the training material, and does it meet the constitutional requirements, or does it fall so far below that they, the entire department needs to be held accountable for that. So I have had access to all kinds of information about training because it really is part and parcel of the litigation process. And I think, you know, one thing that has always troubled me is a shoot, don't shoot training, where it's as always, I see Mary nodding her head. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think greater emphasis on when not to shoot. It's so important. I think what has been troubling to me is that when there's a shooting, the departments then immediately run out and get an expert who will come in and say, it's good shoot. Any shooting is good shooting, right? When you dig in your mm-hmm. heels like that, and you don't have an overview, you don't take a look at where things have gone wrong, those are the departments that repeat their mistakes and they will get sued again. It is much better for them in all various ways to take responsibility and say, we're going to change that because that didn't work, right? So there was a police expert that came in and basically wrote an article saying that any shooting that happens to suspect's back is justified.
We should probably explain to our audience what shoot, don't shoot is.
Yeah, so Mary, tell us your experience about shoot, don't shoot.
Well, I thought you could do that, but my experience, and I took the training, and failed miserably, by the way, took the training in like the early 80s, I think. And what it is a simulated village mm-hmm. or town or business district. And you have, you know, like a storefront or whatever, and you're walking through, and then all of a sudden something pops out. An individual, an animal, whatever.
Yeah.
And in my department, the sheriff's department, there was a complaint coming from the black and brown officers that all of the bad guys were dark skin. even the little old lady was dark skin. So there was, and I don't know that it helped me in my training. You know, I don't know that it allayed the fears. And I would suggest, because every time you hear, you know, you see a shooting, and we have far too many of them, there is, well, you know, we're going to have to step up our training program. You know, no amount of training is going to get someone not to shoot somebody in the back. They're just, it's just not. What do you mean training? You know, you have to act professionally. You know, they seem to be okay, and their training kicks in white communities, but not in black and brown communities. And that's, you know, that's what the problem is. It's not training. It is internal beliefs coming from, I've been in briefings, 6 o'clock in the morning, where, you know, the racism was palpable. I mean, you could feel it. Yeah. And there's no training that's going to stop that. I have been in training with police officers, you know, conducting training, and have them throwing darts at me because they don't like it. But I think, you know, police departments, the trainings, I mean, they have to do that. You know, you know, there's all that macho stuff going on, you know, 70-80%, and then you've got 10% or 20% devoted to community relations, or, you know, whatever the buzzwords are. But, you know, I don't know. Sorry. I tend to get on my soapbox every two or three times we have these discussions, because it is frustrating.
No, that's a perfect segue into what I kind of wanted to talk about. It's not even just necessarily lethal force. What I'm talking about also is training people to handle the community that they serve, even yes. people who are serving in particular communities. What I find interesting is that, and I don't think this is an anomaly, whenever I interact with a community member whose child has been, you know, mistreated in some way by the police, you look at the reports, and it is significant that when the police, white police officers, are interacting with children who are African American, they, for whatever reason, think that they're like 15 years older.
Yes. Yeah.
Especially with Black girls, right? Mm-hmm. It's a 12-year-old looks to a police officer to be a 25-year-old,
sure.
Right? And then, of course, there is a little bit of that bias, sometimes a lot. It's not intentional sometimes, but it is implicit that they see criminality with a certain race.
Yes. Even
African-American police officers do that same thing. Especially when they come through the jails first. I have this personal thing about not starting officers in the jails. I just think that's wrong training, because they spend the first 2-3 years only dealing with the people in custody, and they really start to have concrete ideas about criminality and race, right? So I think that's very dangerous. But I think there is just lack of training about, like, here is real life situation. This is what you're going to confront when you look at children. You know, maybe you should be thinking about that when you're making assumptions based on race. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tamir Rice was 12, mm-hmm. and they said the person who called in said he looked like he was about 24, 25 years old.
That's right. That happens so frequently.
Yeah.
It's not just police officers, but it is people who call in. So really taking that into account when you're having an interaction with the people that you serve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We forget that sometimes, though. They're our employees.
That's right.
And actually, that I'm sorry, Matt. Did you
go ahead, please.
Go ahead. You mentioned lawsuits, and there's a recent study by David Schultz out of the Minnesota Law Journal, and he. Because it's usually not the police department that pays when that lawsuit wins. It's the taxpayer who pays. Mm-hmm. And they did a deep study, which is really hard because it's hard to get that data from the various cities. But they looked at the top 15 cities by population and found civil rights violation payouts during the George Floyd protests approached $2 billion. But because the police departments aren't paying that, you know, is there a way to make them feel that pain rather than just the taxpayer? You know, we're getting hurt twice. We're getting hurt when we protest and the police abuse us, and then getting hurt when we have to pay the bill.
I agree with you. And that is consistent in the state of California. However, when you are self-insured, you also have to have excess insurance carrier, right? So each municipality will have a limit on how much they will pay. And after that, they have to have another insurance policy.
Juliet, could I interrupt just a second? Just for our audience, could you explain what that means, that a municipality or a locality is self-insured?
Sure. So when I say municipality, it's cities and counties, not the state of California. So that they have their own issues, but it's typically talking about cities and counties that have self-insured, meaning that they're not insured by Allstate or State Farm. They pay into a fund, and when they get sued, that fund pays for the misconduct. And because these activities happen within the course and scope of their employment, the police officer gets indemnified, meaning if the jury says you have to pay X amount, it does not come out of the police officer's pocket unless there are certain circumstances that's egregious, it was intentional conduct or whatever have you. 99% of the time, it comes out of the self-insurance pile. But once it reaches that amount, there's no more money. It does not come out of taxpayers' pockets. It is paid out by the insurance company. And that actually has the weird effect of holding some departments accountable. because the excess insurer can say, you know what, your training is horrible.
Right.
It's your fault. You are such a bad department. You are no longer insurable. So we're out, right? That puts the municipality in such a dangerous position because you could have a George Floyd situation any day. If your department and your training is so bad that an insurer is about to leave you, chances are you're going to get sued for big money damages. So when somebody sues and gets a large amount, that almost immediately, depending on the size of the verdict, that sometimes has an immediate impact from the department's reaction because they don't want to lose that excess insurer.
We had two questions in the Q&A. I think you may have answered them. What about the systemic issues that encourage bad officers, such as training that teaches them to become paranoid and aggressive, which I think also falls in with, do you think police can educate officers on a regular basis on the ethics of being a police officer?
Yeah, I love that question. And it really should be a part of the curriculum. And actually, when you look at the language of POSE, there's some really beautiful language about respecting human life. I think it's number one of all the curriculum, that you respect human life, you serve at the pleasure of the people of the state of California. All of those things are written down, but I'm not sure how much that is emphasized on a day-to-day. You know, when you have roll call, is that ever read to you? Does your supervisor ever say, you know, go out there and be safe? And by the way, right, we serve at the pleasure. These are our customers, right? We owe them an obligation. That's not taught every day. That's not reminded every day. But I think that we really need to look at the culture and see how we can change. Just because we've been doing it for hundreds of years one way does not mean it's working. And, you know, it is broken, so we should fix it. Right. But I love that thought of that should be a constant reminder whenever we have training sessions. We really should be talking about that.
Yeah. POSE's training was supposed to be established under the Robert Peel principles. And one of those principles, in effect, I think it's the very last one that's listed of the 15, that says police are the people and people are the police. Therefore, it should be an accurate representation of who it is that you're serving, which I think, to your point, is something that is lost along the way.
And Robert Peel, remind me, is the father really of modern policing.
Correct.
Yes, yeah. From England.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, and I'll let you read the last question, Matt, if that's okay.
Yeah.
You were here. You know, you found out that I just moved from California to New York, and I came through the eyes of looking at it through the eyes of a sociologist, which I find so fascinating. One of the things I've found is that you see police on the street, you know, they're still beat cops who are walking the beat, yet they make no they make no effort to interact with the public. They're standing, usually two of them at a time. Michael, you may have noticed this also, standing two at a time on their cell phones or talking to each other, but making very little eye contact with the public, not looking around, not seeing if, you know, obviously if you're in Bergdorf Goodman, I don't go in there, but if you're standing outside Bergdorf Goodman, there's not going to be a whole lot of crime, I suppose, but still you have to be vigilant. And they're not. So there's a complete disengagement from the community, a complete disengagement, unless it's a negative engagement.
I was always shocked to see how many of them are reading their phones.
Yes, yeah.
And how risky that is from a law perspective.
Yeah. Very much.
Even in jails, as they're processing inmates.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Phones, oh my God.
Yeah. They're. I don't know. But I think. Do we have one more question, Matt? And then.
There is one more, and it is: what about training officers for peaceful protest? I think this kind of goes along with something that I had in mind is when we're talking about decertification, really, when are we looking at the breakdown of public trust? Follow me.
I'm sorry, I'm going to break that down into, there were two questions, right? One was...
Yeah, so peaceful how about policing peaceful protests and then violating the public trust.
Yeah, in terms of protests, I feel like what happened with Occupy was such a steep learning curve. Everybody messed that up. Everybody, right? For the vast majority of people who showed up on the streets, that happened in San Diego as well, there was a swift overreaction. And they just were not equipped. They were not trained to deal with people who were just there being peaceful, being present. They didn't know what to do. So when they gave a disbursement announcement, they felt like that was enough. And once you didn't move, when they told you to move, that was enough for them to use force and take them in. They've come a long way since then, but there is a lot of overreaction by the police. And I understand psychologically with protests, it can be unnerving because you are outnumbered. I get that. Mm-hmm. But that's why you are trained. That's why you're trained to deal with masses and to not overreact and take somebody's eye out because somebody threw a bottle that hit nobody. Mm-hmm. Okay? There are so many cases like that where people have been seriously injured and they are either standing or they're speaking, but there is no show of violence or hostility towards the police that will materialize in anything that's harmful to the police. So training is everything under those circumstances, not just like when to shoot at somebody, but I'm talking about kettling, about orders, about having a safe execution of where to move the people, because sometimes you're moving people, but it doesn't make any sense. You're creating a hazard by doing that. You know, you're screaming things like the incident on the Brooklyn Bridge. You're screaming things, but the people in the back can't hear you. So you're shouting into the air. And when they don't move, you start to arrest them or use pepper spray, whatever tools you have. But you can't do that. You have to plan ahead of time. It's not a mystery what happens when there's a peaceful protest. You should be prepared for that and trained for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that does it. My dog has decided to bark as soon as I turn my mic on. I think that does it for us today. We reserve the right to call you back, Julia, when something comes up. I hope that we start to see the results of SB 2. I don't know if you know, if you remember who Helen Zia was. She gained prominence. She was the first and only civil rights woman of color, a lawyer who was a civil rights lawyer, woman of color. She gained prominence in the death of Vincent Chin. In Detroit in the 1970s, I think. And although, you know, the people who killed Vincent Chin were never served any time, Helen went on to have a really great career in civil rights. And I kind of thought you were channeling her at one time there. So you stand on the shoulders of a giant, at least one giant, Julia. So thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. We'll talk soon. Take care.